A former service member of the United States Air Force, Damaris Hill has taken a bit of a winding path towards becoming a writer and professor. With two PhDs, one in English and the other in women and gender studies, she's never let barriers get in her way, on the page or in person.
I occupy white male spaces all of the time. The military wasn't the first time, but my introduction into the military, I walk into spaces that people think are reserved for white men all of the time. So my mere presence is an agitation.
Stay with us to hear Damaris Hill read from A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, a finalist for the 2019 NAACP Image Award for an outstanding literary work of poetry. That's ahead here on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing has an unusual subtitle for a poetry book. The incarceration of African-American women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. Personal and historical, the book also contains black and white photos of freedom fighters, famous black women writers, and her own family, as it tells stories from slavery, Reconstruction, the Jim Crow era, and our current prison industrial complex era, which has increased the number of incarcerated women by 700% since 1980. Today's program, which is excerpted from the 2019 Writers at Work series, the topic is on writing on race, which featured the writers Damaris Hill and Anthony Grooms on stage with novelist and creative writing teacher at UMKC, Whitney Terrell. Because both their books referred to historical lynchings, that was prominent in their discussion. We heard about Anthony Grooms' novel, The Vain Conversation, in our previous episode of New Letters on the Air, which you can find a link to on our website, newletters.org. Now here's Whitney Terrell at the Kansas City Public Library on the plaza.
The other writer we're going to have today is a poet from the University of Kentucky who teaches in their creative writing program, Damaris Hill. She's also a graduate of the PhD program at Kansas University, so she's local. She knows the plaza. She's already recommended a good restaurant to go after the show. I have been lucky to have her as a guest on the Fiction Nonfiction podcast, which I co-host at Literary Hub. And her new book of poetry, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, is a tremendous collection of poems that meditates on women who have been incarcerated, but also bound in different ways by gender and by race over time. Damaris, if you could just start off for us.
Sure. When I was graduating from the University of Kansas, I was writing a novel about little girls that went to jail in Kansas. And it's a very queer and special thing, even more queer than this book. And that's actually how I landed my agent. And then a year after I was working with my agent, she read my poetry and she said, "Your poetry's coming out first." And this is like 5 years ago. And I was like, "Listen, lady, poetry will not allow me to pay off any bills. Stop talking crazy to me. We got to get this novel out here." Needless to say, the poetry came out first. She's a very smart lady.
Very good press, too.
I'm the first American poet on Bloomsbury. Living American poet on Bloomsbury. I'm very grateful to J.K. Rowling and other people that allowed them to make enough money to take a risk on me. But yeah, my agent had a lot of foresight. She was like, "This is the book." And so we worked on it for 2 years and then it came out. But hopefully the next book will be my novel told from 12 different points of view. So A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing is my poetry manuscript. But it's also one of Publishers Weekly's top 10 history books. So it has some histories there. And it also incorporates archives as a way of reclaiming these women outside of the public narratives about them.
You use the term bound in the title of your collection to mean several different things. You know, in one sense, you're talking about women who are incarcerated or in other ways disenfranchised due to their gender or race. But in another sense, you talk about how you feel that you are bound in the sense of being beholden to others, particularly your ancestors, both familial ancestors and poetic ancestors. Could you talk a little bit about how that word's working for you in this text?
Sure. So this is my third first poetry manuscript. I've probably been writing it for a long time, about since 2001, in different shapes and different forms.
The longer it takes, the better it is what I say.
I hope so. But around the second draft, I came up with the word bound to talk about the ways that I adhere to form. Initially, as a writer, I enjoyed form because it was a puzzle. But then as I developed as a writer, I found more pleasure in breaking the form. And so Bound is really about adhering to a legacy and adhering and staying within these constraints, but it's also very much so about springing forward. So I'm not only beholden to my ancestors, but I'm also beholden to my futures, you know? Those are the bookends of my life. Those are the pages in which I'm bound.
So, Damaris, talking about those ancestors that we were talking about, you feel bound to, and your way of using that term, in the first few poems of the book, you focus on Lucille Clifton as a poet whose history is important to you, but you also make a connection to another kind of binding because you write a poem about Lucy Sale, who was Lucille Clifton's great-grandmother, speaking about the kudzu of race relations in the South, right, and who was the first black woman granted a trial and subsequently hanged in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could read us that poem.
I can read you that poem, but it's also important to talk about the race relations in the South, because the reason...
I would kind of like to take out the in the South part.
Well, race relations in America,
yeah,
right?
Because it is not different here.
It's not. Okay. And it's not really different in the North.
It makes people here feel like we're somehow not a part of that thing that's going on there, but we are a part of it.
So Lucy Sales, again, was Lucille Clifton's great-grandmother, but her mother, Caroline, had been a midwife to many people in the community and had birthed many of the children in the community. And so when Lucy Sales shot her lover for, I guess his sin was creating a baby with her that was disabled, and she thought it was the sins of the father that had disabled her child. And so subsequently, you know, he was shot off his horse. But when the community came to lynch Lucy, right? Because this is shortly after emancipation, it was Caroline that invoked this sense of nationalism and authority and said, "You will not take my daughter. My daughter is entitled to a trial. You will not take her from here." And so I included her in this ancestral part of the book that opens with my grandmother and then transcends into poems about Lucille Clifton, who was very important to me in my development as a woman and also as a poet, because it was important to her. And it's a remnant or a poetic form of a vignette that she wrote about Lucy in her book, Generations, which is also coincidentally a book of personal archives and lyrical vignettes. So I'm going to read to you Licorice for Lucy. Harvey Nichols always keeps a pocket full of licorice, some gum and glove for Lucy's tongue. He wants to hold her mule outside the doorstep long enough to jump back and forth across the broom. Time enough for Lucy to wear his wishes like a veil. When the South is null and Confederate Nichols are weaker than foil, some think Nichols is the devil, the same band fiend as his friend Abe Lincoln, because he's a braggart. He has his Lucy, and he boasts that she is one thing in the South that remains unbroken. Lucy warns him that a new South don't make her any more fit for new masters. Their son's withered arm is no omen. It is twinned to the tree knot outside of Nichols' home. His white wife considers the twinning a blessing and stops wishing for the baby to be baptized in bleach water in her wash bin. Nichols' horse is the only witness. The beast left the body burning beside the sulfur stream of bullet casings and returned with a mob hungry to remember the smell of spiced candy. They want to watch the spittle from Lucy hang like some soft mirror of a noose.
Licorice for Lucy, for Lucille Clifton's great-grandmother Lucille Sales. That's from the first section of the book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, the incarceration of African-American women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. The author, Damaris Hill, is talking with Whitney Terrell at the Kansas City Public Library. This is New Letters on the Air.
I think that in my tales, right, in my stories, that a reoccurring theme is that black women in these stories are very much invested in democratic principles. Like, you can't have a person like Assata Shakur or Angela Davis if they did not have a religious faith in the principles that this country claims that they value.
Of like the Declaration of Independence.
Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. I mean, that's all of Sandra Bland too, right?
Yeah.
And so these people, these women particularly that are demonized in this country for being revolutionary, in my opinion, are the people that hold most true values that America says.
Well, I always thought that was true. For me, the things that I learned the most about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution was when I was studying with James Allen McPherson at Iowa. And
absolutely.
Jim was a devotee of Ralph Ellison, and in Ralph Ellison's essays, he's always looking back to the principles of America's founding. And I find that white writers forgot about those principles or don't think about them. And I found a renewal of faith in American principles by reading Ralph Ellison in many ways. You also have some poems that you dedicate to Ida B. Wells and the way that she kept a record of lynchings in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of hard to read because they have a lot of math in them.
They do. Yes, they do.
But I wondered if you could talk about those poems some. And if you want to read one, go for it.
I'll just read the opening paragraph.
Okay, yeah. I was thinking, like, I don't know how she would read these, but let's see how she would read them.
You have to read this poem out loud because it's linguistically rationalized and mathematically rationalized based on the statistical data that Ida B. Wells gathered about lynching. It's important to know that Ida B. Wells did not set out to be a social activist for lynching. Her best friend's husband was torn from her best friend's bed and lynched. And in love and solidarity, Ida B. Wells began documenting lynching. And it's important to talk about how these black women that are engaged in political activity and nationalism, even when it seems that it's not related, they are related and in conversation with one another. And I try to demonstrate that throughout the book. This was also written around the time that Prince died. So I use the song Thieves in the Temple, because I have 3 degrees in English. I do not have a degree in mathematics. as some type of mental incentive. Music works to heighten my sensibilities. And so the 4 days that I spent writing this poem, I was also meditating on Prince's Thieves in a Temple, which is a song about sexual assault. And we know that lynching was often coupled with the sexual assault of black women and the ongoing rape, sodomizing, paramour rights, and taking of black women, right? And so this poem is at least 2 pages long, and if you continue to read it like that, it will weigh on your body. Like, I had to stop reading it in North Carolina because I almost vomited. The speed of light is almost equivalent as love come in a hurry. There are thieves in the temples. Circa 1892 equals 241 lynched. This means that they were torn from their wives' arms, and there was rope, and then there was a tree, and all of that was put into flames. And this became the act of white supremacy and mob violence. See, 26 states are almost proportional to being united. And this means that in Alabama, there were at least 22 men lynched. And then in Arkansas, 25 or more. Let's not forget California, 3 or more. Florida, there were equivalent to 11 or more people lynched. And in Georgia, 17 or more. And in Idaho, at least 8. In Illinois, we know of at least one man that hung. In Kansas, there were at least 3. And in Kentucky, 9 or more. In Louisiana, 29 were recorded. And in Maryland, 1. In Mississippi, there were 16 plus men. In Missouri, there were at least 6. In Montana, there were at least 4 men that hung. In New York, we speak of 1, possibly more. In North Carolina, there were at least 5 people. In Ohio, 3 or more. In South Carolina, 5 people swung from trees. In Tennessee, the total was at least 28 people lynched. In Texas, there were at least 15 in Virginia, 7 or more in West Virginia, 5 or more in Wyoming, 9 or more in Arizona Territory. We documented at least 3 and in Oklahoma. This is the Durkal Delta, the multiplied increase in surge in lynchings. The speed of light is almost equivalent as love come in a hurry. There are thieves in the temples, 160 Negroes, and that is approximately 80 others and at least 5 women. And there were no less than 2 states over the Mason-Dixon, and one of them claims to be free. The square root of black economic progress is the whole sum and diameter of pure gold American racism and the demon possession of Francis Willard's good Christians. That's Ida B. Wells.
And that's just the first part of 8 sections that celebrate the great African-American journalist, educator, and suffragette in Damaris Hill's book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. You're listening to New Letters on the Air's excerpts of the February 2019 program on Writing on Race, part of the Writers at Work series at the Kansas City Public Library with Whitney Terrell.
One of the things that you said there, you're talking about the square root of black economic progress equals, you know, repression in a way, right? I wondered if one of the reasons why you came to focus on this history of lynchings in America because you felt that there were parallels happening in the current day with Black Lives Matter or with police shootings, which you talk about in the intro to your book. Mm-hmm. Or was there some other reason why you came back to this
subject?
Well,
I mean, both of those reasons are the obvious reasons,
yeah.
Right?
My job is to say the obvious thing.
Right, right. Well, not say the obvious thing, but you know. Let's think about 4 years ago, we were seriously interrogating the 1%, right?
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting?
This is like a way
we were seriously interrogating, you know.
Talking about like Occupy Wall Street and the
Occupy Wall Street and the distribution of wealth in this country.
Right. And so people can think about race instead of capitalism would be better for people with a lot of money.
Right. Let's just speculate. Let's just explore, right? But we can also begin to explore the American mythology of social hierarchies. And Ida B. Wells was also documenting over and over again, which people do not discuss, how most of the men that were lynched were economic strongholds in the black community in the regional spaces
Yes.
Right? And so in the middle of it is really black economic progress and the totality of how it totally defeats and instantly debunks these mythologies about social hierarchies that says if you're white, you're better, or if you're male, you're better, or if you're rich, you're better. But this black family or this black man or this black person, just in their sheer human experience, challenges that in every interval. And that's why I think Ida B. Wells' calculations are just as important as the social activism that she engaged in. And I was going to bring Harriet Tubman in because, you know, Harriet Tubman says, I freed 1,000 people. I could have freed thousands more if they knew they were slaves. The mythology of race makes you believe that you're not oppressed when now you can't even claim your children that are in college on your taxes.
So, Damaris, you were in the military, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you write about that some toward the end of your book. I wondered if you could talk about how it made you think about America.
Well, there are a lot of things that make me think about America, right? Like my European ancestors came here in the 1780s, and my African ancestors and indigenous ancestors were already here, right? So this is like shortly after the revolution. And then also, my family has been involved in the AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church, for many generations. And that, along with the Gullah culture, I think are two of the most prominent manifestations of American culture in the United States. You know, we are Methodist, but it's very civically engaged, right? And very independent in those ways. But then on top of that, my grandfather was in the Army Air Corps and very invested in developing infrared technology. And he's a veteran of Vietnam and the Korean War. My father is a veteran of Desert Storm. He managed all Protestant ministers. And I joined the United States Air Force National Guard. My skill set was missiles and bombs, and I had no idea what my grandfather did. So when they tested me and came back and they were like, your electronic score is very high. And I was like, that's a mistake. And they were like, no, it's not. It's significantly higher than anything else, and we'll pay you extra to learn this skill. And so I took the cash, right? Not knowing that this was something that I also inherited. Right? Because my grandfather would never reveal that information. I found out what my grandfather did probably shortly before he died. You know, I knew that he lived in a lot of Cold War places, and so did my family, but I had no idea what he was truly engaged in until he admitted to me why he would never get in a plane again. Because through the Korean War and the Vietnam War, he laid in the bottom of the plane and told the pilots where to bomb, based on the technology that he had helped develop and train people around the world to use. He'd never lay in the bottom of a plane again. He'd never get on a plane again. That's when I learned we had that connection. So, you know, I've never been married, and I had my son very young. So for me, I joined the military because my homegirl, I can say it now because she's retired, she was a reservist working at the Pentagon. And I was in ROTC, and I'm not into, like, field sleeping and all of that. I'm not into organized PT. And she called me, and she was like, girl, they have this thing for you. It's called the Air National Guard. No PT and no field training. I was like, great. And so as my parents were working through their divorce, which was very expensive and disrupted a lot of the financial stability of my life, I was able to go into the Air National Guard, which at that time was a great deal. So, like, not only did I get cash up front for learning, you know, certain types of things about weapons, but in the state that I lived in, they gave you back half your tuition in cash if you went to a state school, regardless of how you paid for it. So I was able to have a work-study job and be a mother, a single mother and head of household. From there, I started teaching public schools, and I remained in the National Guard. And then I eventually moved into higher education. But it's just an exploration of life, right? Like, there are rules and cultures in every space that you occupy. And so, like, and let's be clear, I almost got kicked out of boot camp twice. You know, I am who I am in whatever space that I occupy. I can be educated, but I can't really be trained. So that was also true for boot camp, you know? That was very true.
Damaris Hill, who managed to avoid the Air Force's physical test of sit-ups, push-ups, and a timed run, but gained endurance in other ways as a writer and teacher. We've been hearing her talk about her 2019 poetry book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing. Her previous works include The Fluid Boundaries of Suffrage and Jim Crow, Staking Claims in the American Heartland, and the poetry collection Visible Textures. You're listening to excerpts from the On Writing on Race program at the Kansas City Public Library with some responses to audience questions about her teaching.
You know, I teach in Kentucky, where 71% of the state openly voted for 45. They like to tell you about it, you know. Sometimes those students end up in my classrooms. That's interesting.
But you can talk to them then. I mean, that's...
Yeah, you know, I hope they
productive.
I hope they have a conversion experience. And if they don't, it's at least a space where they will be challenged. One of my darling alt-right students tried it one day. And it was, like, so beautiful because, you know, democracy is so integrated into my classroom that, like, three or four students immediately spoke up and, like, challenged him and really made him unpack his statement before I could even correct him. So I like all students.
Let's
be very clear about that. I really, really do. I like all students. I enjoy students. I just do. I like to see students develop. I'm a real hippie teacher. Like, if I didn't have to give grades, I wouldn't. Like, I'm a real, people that know me know exactly how hippie I am. So I'm a real hippie teacher because I feel that that's a part of democracy. And I feel like making a student is not about teaching them the, like, outline skills of the course, but making them useful in a society that we're going to all occupy. Like, that's a goal for me. But I teach creative writing I teach horror stories in American history and culture. That's like African American studies. And some horror stories, should I say. I teach American literature. And I study cultures, which includes 21st century digital cultures. When I get to California, I'm going to give a talk about how artificial intelligence is learning to be racist. So that's the new frontier.
Look for more exploration and poetry by Damaris Hill in a forthcoming book, also from Bloomsbury Publishing in 2022. In the meantime, her collection, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland, is now out in paperback in 2020. We'll finish out today's program with some words to the audience from Damaris Hill about poetics and life.
Whatever you're doing, the key to doing it well is to play hard. Push every boundary, play really, really hard. The literature that I loved most when I was learning to write was Latino literature. And I was devastated by the fact that English does not allow me the sounds that Spanish allows me in terms of the assonance and the rhyming. And so forms kind of helped me to get those sounds in place and that kind of musicality that I wanted in the poetry. But when I learned how to break the constraints is when I learned to stop mimicking and really do my own call. And so then I became addicted to the ways that I could break the constraints and remain in conversation with this American culture. And I also have the first poem in the book done in a remix form online. So if you type Damaris Hill, the remix, you can see a digital version that combines film, public archives, private archives, text, voice, and music.
All right. Well, everybody, please give our guests a round of applause.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you so much for coming.
Damaris Hill, on stage with the Writers at Work host Whitney Terrell and novelist Anthony Grooms at the Kansas City Public Library in February 2019. For links to hear Anthony Grooms' part of this On Writing, On Race discussion, visit our website, newletters.org. Our regular audio archives and podcast are temporarily disabled as we rebuild our website, but we can point you to our Public Radio Exchange page to listen to previous shows. Go to newletters.org and click on New Letters on the Air, then click Listen to find Anthony Grooms on PRX. While you're on our website, consider subscribing to New Letters Magazine. Our newest issue features the New Letters Fiction Award winner, Primates, by Donna Gordon, a story chosen by this year's esteemed judge, who happens to be the very same Anthony Grooms. If you appreciate what we do in print and on the radio, please consider supporting our literary operation. Again, go to newletters.org and just click on Donate. You can also keep up with the show, magazine, and press by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with our student interns, Amina Dalton, Henry Shee, Anna Stokes, and Evan Lohman. Thanks especially to our assistant producer, Jamie Walsh, and to you for listening and supporting New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam.